I am very grateful to all of you for being with us this evening. Thank you very much. It is my honor and my fortune to be with you. When my very dear friend, His Holiness Bhakti Tirtha Swami, requested me to write this book about my journey in search of truth and God, I was extremely reluctant. I was thinking, if I tell the truth, who will believe me? But he emphasized that this is not your story. This is everyone's story. Because everyone is looking for a meaningful, fulfilling life. And people are looking in so many ways, in so many directions for meaning and fulfillment. And I realized that the details of my story may be something very personal, but the principle of the quest for fulfillment is everyone's story. We're all trying to find a home. Home is where we're completely free, where we're comfortable, where we're with people we love and people who love us. This is the idea of home. That home is within the heart of every living being. And if we cannot find our home within our own hearts, in our relationship, the soul's relationship with God, and in that relationship, understanding our spiritual relationship with all beings, then we'll never really feel at home anywhere. But if we find that home within our hearts, we can feel our home everywhere. I think many of you have read The Journey Home. I'd like to just tell a few stories of some things that happened after that particular era. You may remember when I left Vrindavan because my visa expired in India. This was in 1972. I went to Nepal for some time. And while I was there, I was staying in so many different kinds of places, sometimes in caves, sometimes under trees. At one point, it was somewhere near the Kathmandu Valley. I slept for a few days in a cow shed with cows. And while I was there, does everyone know what lice is? Lice are tiny little insects that like to suck your blood. And usually when you get one, you get hundreds and hundreds and hundreds. So somehow or other, while living with the cows, my body, not in my hair, but body lice, from my neck to my feet, was covered with lice. Little tiny insects that just, they're kind of, when you look at them from outside, they're round. And they suck your blood. And they itch terribly. My body was itching so bad because it was covered with lice. But I learned from Bhagavad Gita, Vidyavanaya Sampani Brahmani Gavi Hastini Suni Chaiva Swapakita Pandita Samadarsha. That real knowledge is to see every living being with equal vision. To have compassion for the sacredness of life in everyone. So, in my consciousness, at this time I was only about 21 years old or something, 21, 22, and I was very enthusiastic about my discovery of truth and bhakti and Krishna and the Atma and the Paramatma. And I was thinking that every one of these lice is my brothers and sisters. They're all part of God. And somehow or other, they have made their home in my body. This, what I found in Vrindavan, in their own way, they were finding in me. It was like their journey home was me. So they were itching and they were biting, but I would offer my pranams to the lice as I would chant God's names, and I would chant in such a way that a little louder than usual for all the lice could hear it. And this went on for maybe a month and a half. And I had to leave Nepal. Then I got a 2-week tourist visa to India. I went back through Vrindavan. Then from Delhi, I flew to Europe. And then by an inconceivable arrangement, I was completely bereft and in desperation in Amsterdam. People were attacking me and harassing me because I was a little sadhu with matted hair and a lungi and a chador and a begging pot in downtown Amsterdam. And American sailors were harassing me. And somehow I went down a little alleyway and I saw on the left side an old garage with a sign saying Radha Krishna Temple. And it was the middle, about midnight. So I knocked on the door. And there was a devotee of Krishna who answered the door. He was a Dutch boy. His name was Sudarshan. And he saw me, and I was quite desperate, and he let me in. And I remember the experience. I had just been accosted by prostitutes, bullied by sailors. People threw they threw a whole keg of beer over my head in the freezing cold. And here I was now in this very beautiful temple. There was incense burning. There was a beautiful tape playing of Srila Prabhupada, my guru, singing. There was wonderful paintings of Krishna and Radha and Vrindavan on the walls. And he came to me And I asked him, could I take a bath to wash this beer off me? And after I took a bath, he gave me hot milk with bananas and cardamom. And I was so happy. I was thinking, this is like an oasis in a desert. So I made my residence at that ashram for about a month. And the brahmacharis, or the monks, they all lived in a little loft. There was about 10 of us. A little loft. It was quite crowded. We slept on the floor together. And my body was itching so bad, but I would never scratch it, because I was afraid if I scratched it, I would cause pain to one of the lice. So I just tolerated it. And after some time, it became just a part of my life. It was like it didn't even bother me anymore. The itching just became the normal way a body feels. But one day, several weeks later, one of the monks or brahmacharis saw on the floor a little lice crawling. And I was the only one up there at the time. He became so upset, because he was a Dutch boy, so he didn't know English so good. So he looked at it and he said, "A little animal, a little animal. Where is this little animal coming from?" And then he looked at me. He said, "Do you have little animals?" And I said, "You mean those guys?" He said, "Yes." I said, "You know, they're living beings. They're part of Krishna." And he said, "Are they on you?" And I said, "Yes." And he became so disturbed. He said, "Everyone in the ashram is going to get lice all over their bodies because of you." He said, "You have to take medicine, little animal medicine." And I said, no, I can't do that, because they're people. And, you know, we're devotees of Krishna. We're supposed to see Krishna in everyone and everything." And he became very disturbed, and he went down and told the president of the temple. And the president of the temple was furious. He came running upstairs, and he looked at my body, and he saw hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of these lice. And he said, you have two choices. Either you take the medicine or you get out of here today." And I was talking about how could we kill others for our own sake? He said, "It's not for your sake, it's for everybody else's sake." And then he started telling me about Bhagavad Gita, how Krishna was told to kill the Kurus for the cause of Dharma. So for the cause of Dharma, you have to kill these lice. I didn't understand this. So finally I said, "All right, I will do it." And so he told my friend who discovered them, and he ran to the store and came back, and he said, "I have the little animal medicine for you." And I just wiped it all over my body, and all the lice fell off. They were finished. But I was so sentimental at that time that as I was putting it on, I was loudly chanting Krishna's names. Because I remember Gita tells, "Yam yam vapi smaran bhavam tijatyante kalevaram," that whatever you remember at the time of death, you will attain. And if you remember me at the time of death, you will attain me, Krishna said. So I was chanting, thinking that if the lice hear Krishna's name as they're dying, then they may get a better birth. Maybe they'll get liberated. So that was one of my first experiences of being in the Western world, being harassed, being abused, being misunderstood, and then having the very basis of my philosophy challenged by my own people. Soon after, I visited my parents. That was a challenge. Because I left America a couple years before as a college student, going on a summer vacation with the promise that I would be back for the next semester of college. And I came back a couple years later as a hardcore seasoned Indian sadhu. My father and brother, when they came to the airport, they were shocked. I didn't have any luggage. All I had was a begging pot and a little cloth bag with some scriptures in it and my japa mala, my beads. And I was sleeping outside in their patio because I didn't believe in sleeping inside. So they were adjusting to me, and I was trying to adjust to them. And I got a beautiful lesson in the experience. If I loved and accepted them for who they were, that they would begin to understand who I was. And gradually they did. And their hearts were totally transformed. But while I was there, I heard that my guru, Srila Prabhupada, who I had met in Vrindavan and also in Mumbai, he was in New York City. So I went there to meet him. And I spent about 5 days with Prabhupada and the other devotees. And as he was leaving, there was an announcement that Prabhupada was coming to a community in the Appalachian Mountains called New Vrindavan. Prabhupada was going to be there for Janmashtami. He was going to be there for Vyas Puja, his birthday, and he was going to give a 7-day Bhagavat Katha called Bhagavad Dharma Discourse. And there was about a month before that was about to happen. They needed people to help set up for him. So I decided to go there with the idea that after he left, I would start making my way back to India and Vrindavan. And Srila Prabhupada came. And I was told by so many people that the best way I could serve my guru was to be where I was and try to help his projects. Interestingly, before I left Vrindavan in India, my very dear friend Ghanashyam, who lived in the little closet, actually, his deities were in the closet. He lived outside. He told me, if you have to leave India, you should become a pujari. I never considered such a thing. He said, because I used to love to help him to serve Gopi Jana Ballabha in so many different ways. There were no formalities in his worship. He said, you should become a pujari. So I just listened and was amused by the idea. When I was at New Vrindavan in West Virginia, all the sadhus, or the brahmacharis, were sent to live on a mountain. This mountain was 3 miles up a muddy road from the main community in a 150-year-old broken-down little farmhouse that was made into a temple. And we put deities of Radha Krishna there. And there was about 15 brahmacharis that moved up there. And I was put in charge of the cows, which I was very happy with. So every day I would milk the cows. There were 4 cows that I was serving. I even remember their names: Kalia, Dudya, Basya, Kamaduk. They were all named by Srila Prabhupada personally. And I would milk them, and then I would have this steel brush, and I would brush every single hair of their body. And I realized when I brushed them that cows are ladies, and ladies like to look nice. And when I brushed them, they would just be smiling at me, and then I would have a little stick and I would take them out to the pasture. And I would take them to where the nicest, greenest grasses were. And they would literally, after I brushed them and gave them plenty of water and milked them, ultimately, everyone wants to feel loved. I heard so many things about cow protection. But cow protection, I understood, it doesn't just mean not killing them. There's physical protection, but there's also emotional protection. By giving them the medicines when they need medicines, by giving them the food and the nourishment and the water that they need. But the way we do it, if it's done with love, with respect, with affection, they feel that love. And when I was brushing them, I would brush them with so much affection, and they could feel it. They were so happy. They would lick me. I would call their names and they would come running. And when I would go to milk them, they would hardly even kick because there was a reciprocation. Of course, some of the others did. Reciprocate. Sometimes our love, we cannot expect love in return. Sometimes we get it, sometimes we don't, but we give. That is a spiritual sense of love. So I would take them out to the pasture. They would be so happy. And I'd let them graze through the day, and meanwhile I would be cutting wood, and I had a little oxen, and I would get like dead trees and bring it back because we had no heat there. All the cooking was done with wood that we'd have to get from. I would chop up the trees into little pieces and make it and cook it into cook all the offerings with the little stove someone. And then in the afternoon I would call all the cows by their names, and I would see these calls, and I'd go out to the pasture and bring them back and milk them. And after a few weeks, the person who was the pujari left the ashram. So the leader of the ashram came to me and said, there's no one to take care of Radha Vrindabhanath, the names of the Murtis. He said, so we would like you to be the pujari. I said, well, I'm taking care of the cows. And he said, well, you can do both. So I said, whatever I'm supposed to do, I will do. So then I became the pujari. And after some time, I was thinking, Ghanasyam told me to be a pujari. Now I'm a pujari. So I spent about 7 years as a pujari, just on the altar all day and taking care of the cows, those two things. And during that time, I would love to sing for the deities, and I would love to sometime I would cook for the deities. And it was just a very solitary life. 15 people would be there in the morning and night, and from 6:30 till in the morning till 7 at night, it was usually just myself and sometimes one other. Then in 1979, I was asked to share Srila Prabhupada and Lord Krishna's message with the people outside of the community. Did I ever tell you about the first public class I ever gave? How many people know that story? This was in 1979. I had been taking care of cows on this mountain. There was no telephones. There was no, in those days, internet. There was no communication outside of that little mountaintop. So I hitchhiked to a Catholic high school and told them that I would be happy to give a class to your people, to your students. So they said, yes, yes, we'll get a combined class. So three different classes of seniors in high school. There was about 60 people, about 20 people in each class. There was maybe 75 people in the class. And there were three, four teachers that were there. And I spoke about some teachings of the Gita and some universal spiritual principles, and had little kirtan. And then I asked for questions. Now please know, I was living alone on a mountain for 7 years. And before that I was in India, on riverbanks and in caves. First time in my life I ever spoke to the public in a school. And I asked, is there any questions? And this very pretty young American girl raised her hand in the front row. I said, yes. She said, can I ask you a personal question? Now, where I was living on that mountain, I hadn't seen any female except Radharani, Subhadra, because we had Jagannath Baladev Subhadra, and the cows, and Tulsi Devi. They were the only females I had seen in years. And now here I am in a college class, and this young girl asks me in front of everybody, can I ask you a personal question? So I prayed to Krishna silently, and I said, yes, please. Now this was the first question I ever had in my career as a preacher. Are you ready? She asked, why do you smell like a cow? And everyone was laughing. And they were waiting for the answer. And I said, because I milk cows. And I asked if there was any other questions. Somebody said, in your lecture you talked about how there's so many dangers in this world and how you know, when we get out of college, when we get out of high school, we may be drafted in the army and sent to Vietnam. Can you tell me what you meant by this? And I got very enthusiastic because I used to demonstrate back in 1960s. I used to demonstrate against the Vietnam War. And I said, I know people, my friends' brothers, they were killed in Vietnam. They came back as alcoholics and drug addicts because of the stress. Some of them were wounded. So many people die there. And, you know, when you get out of high school, you're eligible for the draft. So we should take our life very seriously. They were looking at me with blank faces. And there was total silence. And then the teacher of the class raised her hand. And she said, the Vietnam War ended 5 years ago. I said, really? They said, you're just living like a half hour away from this school. You didn't know that was the biggest news of the whole world. I said, no, but I'm really happy. This is great news. And then the next question. Somebody asked, what did you mean when you referred to President Nixon? And by then I was understanding my limitation with current events. I said, isn't Nixon still president? And they said, he was three presidents ago. You've been living in America and you didn't even know who the last three presidents are? I said, no. Anyways, I started, you know, reading a few newspapers to try to understand what happened in the last. Do you know the story in Srimad Bhagavatam about Muchakunda? Well, if you ever study that, I felt kind of like that. He was really out of touch with current events. But after some time, I was going to colleges. At first, I was just hitchhiking, and I started organizing a really sweet congregation of families in a place called Meadville, Pennsylvania. And every Sunday, I would hitchhike up there, and they all were becoming very beautiful devotees. They were all working people. And they decided to give me a station wagon, a little car to drive. So then I was going from college campus to college campus. And we started opening centers and like that. But I remember one time I was at Ohio University in Athens, Ohio. This was maybe in 1981. And what I would do is I would teach a vegetarian cooking class in the evening. And during the day, I would sit on the grass of the campus, and I had a little harmonium, and I had a box of laddus that I would cook myself, and I had some little books, Bhagavad Gitas, and I would sing, and I was all alone. I would just go every day to a different college, and I was singing beautiful bhajans. My voice is not beautiful, but the bhajans are beautiful. So I was singing, and students would come over, and I would teach them how to chant, and they would chant with me, and I'd give them some laddus, and then I'd talk to them, and then I'd give them more laddus, and it seemed like they liked laddus. But I was making some really nice friends. And one day, it was in the autumn. In the West, the autumn is just before winter. So it's just starting to get cold and the leaves are falling from the trees. And as I was sitting there with just two or three students who were very, very beautiful-hearted people asking questions about God and about who am I and why is there suffering and what is the purpose of life? They were asking these very sincere questions. Meanwhile, there was a person of another religion who was extremely fanatical, and he was screaming out his message that if you didn't believe in what he believed, that you were going to hell. And he saw two people holding hands, a boy and a girl, and he said, "Sex, you are going to hell." And he saw somebody smoking a cigarette, and he said, "Psst, intoxication, you are going to hell." There was a group of about 100 students in a circle around him, and every time he would condemn somebody, they would all laugh. For them, this man was serious as fire. But for the students, he was just a big joke. So he was just condemning one person after another after another. And then one of the students said, "What about that person over there? Where is he going?" The preacher said, "Who is that?" They said, "He's a Hare Krishna." And then the circle opened so he could see me. He was about 50 meters away from me, and he was staring at me. He had a suit, a tie, glasses, nicely combed hair. He said, "He is going to hell." So one of the students said, "Well, why don't you go and tell him?" He said, "I will." He marched toward me. And I'm just like, Hare Krishna, with my harmonium and talking to students. And he's trampling on the leaves, all these dried leaves that have fallen from the trees. And it's going... And all the 100 students were following him. It was fairly loud, crunching of leaves. And soon he was face to face. I'm sitting down on the grass, and he's standing right over me. And all the 100 students were in a circle around me. And the news spread really fast. It was going to be a fundamentalist Christian against a Hare Krishna. Soon there was about 250 students around us in a big circle, waiting for us. It was something like, to the students, it was like a cricket match between India and Pakistan. So he looked down at me and said, "You are going to hell." There was pin drop silence. There was 250 students, that means 500 ears listening for my reply, and 500 eyes just staring at us. So I said a little prayer, and I replied, "If I'm going to hell, sir, where are you going?" Total silence, waiting for his answer. He said, "I am going to heaven because I believe." And then he explained what he believed. but you are going to hell. Total silence. For about a minute, everyone was waiting, like kegs of dynamite, waiting for what I was going to say. They were ready to explode. What would you have said? I said a little prayer. And I said, "Sir, if you're going to heaven, I think I'll be much happier in hell." Because if heaven is full of fanatics like you, it would be a much nicer place than hell. When I said that, every one of those 250 students exploded in laughter, and they started cheering. Like, they were cheering like anything. And this, and the preacher, he turned totally red. And he didn't know what to say after that. And then I said something. I said, "Sir, why am I going to hell?" He said, "Because you worship a false god." I said, "How do you know I worship a false god?" He said, "Because you worship Krishna." I said, "Do you know who Krishna is?" He said, "Yes, a false god." I said, "Do you know what Krishna means?" He said, "Yes, a false god." I said, "Can I ask you a question?" He said, "Yes." I said, "Is your god all beautiful?" He said, "Of course." "Is your God all-knowing?" He said, "Yes." "Is your God all-wealthy? Is he the most famous? Is he the most kind? Is he the most renounced?" He said, "Yes, of course." I said, "If he has all these qualities, your God, does that make him all attractive?" He said, "Yes." I said, "Well, Krishna means all attractive, so that means your God is Krishna." He said, "What?" I said, "Krishna is not a sectarian concept. Krishna means the all attractive. There's one God for all living beings, and he has many names. Krishna means he's the source of all beauty, the source of all knowledge, the source of all strength, of all wealth, of all knowledge, of all renunciation." We had a dialogue in this way for some time. And he actually, his heart opened up. But because there was about 250 students around, he didn't want it to open up too much. So he said, "I don't know about what you're saying, but I'd like to speak to you more about it another time." And he walked away. And it's kind of a long story. But he shut down our vegetarian cooking class because he considered that we were representing a false religion. But we had 200 students coming to that class every week on a Wednesday night. And they all signed a petition, and they all marched into the dean's office and demanded that the class be continued. So it continued. So this person would come to monitor, to make sure we weren't trying to unnecessarily convert people. And I was teaching, and after several weeks, we had some dialogues. He came up, actually, we didn't have dialogues for a couple of weeks. He came up to me, and he said, "Could I ask you a question?" I said, "Please." I was expecting some very philosophical or theological challenge. He said, "My question is, can you give me the recipe for halva?" He said, "I never tasted anything so good." He said, "I'm the leader of an organization called the Campus Crusaders for Christ. And we meet every Sunday night. And I want to make this halva for them." So I gave him the recipe for halva. And the next week he came up to me. And I asked him, "Did you make the halva?" He said, "Yes." I said, "Did they like it?" He said, "They loved it." He said, "But it wasn't as good as what you make." He said, "There's something different." I said, "That's because I offer this to Krishna." And it becomes prasadam. That means the grace of God. So after you make the halva, you should meditate on preparing it for your God with love and devotion. And try not smelling it or tasting it. Just make it for God's pleasure. And then offer it to God with all your heart's love. And then it becomes his prasad, his mercy. And that's what makes the difference. So the next week he came up. And he said, "I offered it to God, and it became prasadam, and it tasted just like what you make, and the students loved it." He said, "In fact, some of the students have come to the cooking class today." We became really good friends. And after we became good friends, he honored and respected Krishna. I always honored and respected his religion. One day I said to him, "Actually, I changed my mind. I'll be very happy to live in heaven with you." And his reply was, "Me too. I'll be happy to live in heaven with you." And then he closed by saying, "Hare Krishna." And he became one of our greatest supporters. He didn't change his religion, but he became one of our greatest supporters. And he told me that through our relationship, he learned how to seek the essence of his own religion. And by doing so, to see that there was a common essence between all religions. For about 8 years, I was traveling around America giving lectures and teaching courses at universities and colleges in America, and many, many such experiences like this. Until 1987, when I was asked to come to Mumbai and establish an ashram here in a temple. And actually the day after tomorrow at our Radha Gopinath temple, just a few minutes from here, we're celebrating the 25th anniversary of when we began this little temple. Thank you very much. I remember Srila Prabhupada, he would often quote a particular verse from the Bhagavad Purana. Savai pung sang paro dharmo yato bhakti radhokshije ahoitaki apratihata yayatma suprasediti. That the supreme dharma, dharma is sometimes translated as religion, sometimes as occupation, sometimes as duty, sometimes as the inseparable nature of oneself. But the Bhagavad tells the supreme dharma, the param dharma, is that which awakens loving devotional service to the one God, the one supreme God. And such loving devotion must be without being motivated by any selfishness or egoism, and uninterrupted by any situation, however easy or difficult, honor or dishonor, pleasure or pain, happiness or distress. When our service to God and our service to humanity is not disturbed by the inevitable changes in this world, and when it's motivated genuinely, some Siddhira Haditoshanam, for God's pleasure, for the welfare of others, that is the supreme dharma. That's the universal essential principle of all great spiritual paths. And I learned by understanding that principle, we can rise above all these egoism conceptions that is the cause of such strife within humanity and within ourselves. And this was a beautiful gift that my guru Srila Prabhupada had given me, and something through my life and through the journey home, in whatever small way I can, I'm trying to share with the world. If there's any questions, I'll be happy to try to answer. Thank you.
Hare Krishna, sir. I'm Dr. Beena Pansari. My respects at your feet, sir. You talk a lot about the need, fundamental need, to love God, okay? So is this Madhurya Ras? Is this Madhurya Ras? Or it depends on the...
Madhurya means sweet. Love for God is the sweetness that we all long for. Specifically, in Sanskrit, this love of God is prema, prem. Bhav is the preliminary state of the awakening of love. Prem is the fully developed, like the lotus flower that is fully blossomed. Radha Krishna Pranaya Vikritir Ladini Shakti Rasmat. This means that the Absolute Truth is one, Advaita. That one who is the source of everything, Janma Yasha Yataha. The Vedanta Sutra tells The absolute truth is from whom everything emanates. So there is one God. Nam namakari bahuta nija sarva shaktis. That one God has many names, has assumed many forms, both in the spiritual and material worlds. But the source of everything is that one God. But that one supreme absolute truth has both a male and female nature. The Shaktiman, or the energetic source, and the Shakti, the energy. So the male dimension of this is described as the supreme object of love. And the female nature of God is the supreme abode of love. In other words, the supreme lover and the supreme beloved. And the lila, the pastime of God as the supreme lover and the supreme beloved, is the highest truth according to the Vedic literatures. And in many other religions, in the esoteric monastic orders, many also understand that one supreme God in the same way, as the supreme lover and the supreme beloved. So in our Vedic literatures, that supreme lover and beloved, the male and female, have different names. Lakshmi, Narayan. Sita, Ram. Radha, Krishna. Within the context of this material creation, there's Parvati and Shiva. These are all the male and female, the Shakti and Shaktiman. And the concept of the Bhakti tradition is that in the spiritual world, and this is revealed in the Vedas, there is the Brahma Jyoti, the unlimited, formless energy of God that is like the sky, the spiritual sky. But within that spiritual sky, there are planets, spiritual planets, that are such ananda, eternal, full of knowledge and full of bliss. And within those planets, the different aspects of the one supreme truth are having eternal pastimes, or lila, Radha, Krishna. Radha is the source of all love. Radha is the aspect of God that is the source of all compassion. She is the motherly dimension of the absolute truth. And Krishna is the masculine dimension of the absolute truth. And they are inseparable. Just like the sunshine is the energy of the sun, you cannot separate the sun from the sunshine. And you cannot separate the sunshine from the sun. So similarly, Radha and Krishna are one. Lakshmi Narayan are one. In Vrindavan, the philosophy is that we approach the supreme beloved through the supreme lover. By receiving the motherly grace of Sri Radha, then we naturally have total access to the love and the grace of Krishna.
Thank you, sir.
Does that make sense? Thank you.
Could I add something which I have heard from a Braj Rasik seed? Could I add something? I know it. I mean, I'm not even
Please
eligible.
Please keep the microphone close to your mouth.
Please, I'm not eligible to add it, but could I add something? That saint told me that Radha is the soul of Krishna. She's the soul of Paramatma.
In the sense that Sri Radha is the soul of Krishna, and Krishna is the soul of Radha, because their love is so infinitely deep for each other. And ultimately, they are one. They are one in two forms. And Radha is the soul of Krishna because she is the complete manifestation of all love of God. And Krishna is conquered by the love of his devotee. And Radha is conquered by the love of Krishna. So they are each the soul of the other. That is the nature of love in the spiritual plane.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Hare Krishna, my question is that in the book, as a child, you never sat on chairs and you never wore new clothes. I would like to know why.
Because I was very strange. And nobody knew why I was so strange. And even I did not know why I was so strange. But I liked to sit on the floor, but I wasn't allowed to sit on the floor. Actually, we had a dog named Kippy, and he had a little bowl in the kitchen on the floor, and I always wanted to sit next to him. But I wasn't allowed to do that. And I just, somehow or other, I hated chairs. It was obviously from a previous life of sitting on the floor. And so I would stand up and eat. And as far as the clothes, from my early childhood, five, six, seven, 8 years old. I'm from 5 years old up until through my teens, practically. I had this nature that I didn't feel comfortable having more than other people. And I saw some people, when they had more, they would be very arrogant and proud about it. And when I would see that, I actually really respected the poor people who didn't have much of anything. And I didn't want to have more than them. I felt ashamed to have more than them. And it was something quite deep, actually. I was really ashamed of having more than others, so I wanted to be very ordinary. And where did I learn that from? It must have been from a previous life. Because there was absolutely no one around me that was anything like that. And I wasn't reading any scriptures about yogis in those days. I didn't even know what a yogi was. It was something that carried on from a past life. It was my own little way of giving honor to people. I didn't want them to envy me. I didn't want them to feel that I had something they didn't have. That was my nature. Where it came from, it was a mystery. My mother was such a wonderful, loving mother. She had to wash new clothes at least 6 or 7 times till it looked old before I would wear them. And she thought I was... But I would insist. I simply, 5 years old, I would not wear pants or shirt or socks or anything until she washed them about 10 times. And gradually she got used to it. And she just knew that she had to do that. Otherwise I wouldn't wear it. And she would buy me new shoes. And by the time that we got home, she would look and they'd look like they were about 5 years old because I would scrape them with rocks. So.
And now?
Huh?
Are you still the same?
Now I just wear these robes, so nobody's envious of these robes.
One more question. In the book, yes. Time and again in your life, you faced death.
Huh?
Time and again, you faced death.
Hmm.
There were wild dogs attacking you, and you had tuberculosis. But you never ever mentioned in the book, like, why me? Never.
Why me?
Yeah.
Huh.
Did it never occur to you?
I believe there's many times in the book where I asked, why me?
No. You're not.
I think it's there because I was definitely asking that question.
I've read it many times.
I wrote it, so I absolutely... But I kind of remember when the mongoose was in my hair, I was asking, why me? Yes.
Hare Krishna Swamiji, you mentioned that you lived on a mountain with the cows for about 7 years. My question to you is, how did you feel without any human contact? Did you not feel the need to talk to people, to interact, to share your feelings, to just be with people for a very long time?
In the mornings and evenings, some of the other sadhus would come up. I didn't have much time with them. But to be very honest, there was just nothing else in the world I would rather do. I was just so happy serving my guru by taking care of those cows because I felt that was so pleasing to Krishna. And taking care of the deities, I was thinking how fortunate I am to be with Radha and Krishna all day long. And there's just nothing else in the universe I'd rather do. I was very, very happy. When I was asked to go out, actually, I was quite brokenhearted.
Don't you ever get angry?
Huh?
Don't you ever get angry? Or upset?
Do I get angry or upset?
Yeah, do you get angry and upset? It's sometimes hard not to feel that way.
Sometimes I do, actually. But there's nothing necessarily material about being angry, upset, if it's not an expression of our ego or our selfishness. If we're angry or upset in a spirit of compassion, in a spirit of concern, in a spirit of love, then that's a way of expressing devotion. After all, Hanuman was one of the greatest devotees, was he not? When he saw, do you know the story of Ramayana? When he saw Sita in the Ashokvan, being harassed and exploited by Ravan? Was he angry? He was so angry, he tore to pieces the whole garden of Ravan. And when he saw Sita crying and crying and crying in separation from Ram, he was very upset. And when they lit his tail on fire, he didn't just offer his pranams and tolerate it. He jumped on every rooftop and lit the whole city on fire. Yes, he was angry. And he was also upset. But he's praised for that as being the great bhakta, because it was an expression of his love. It wasn't the anger. Material anger is when our selfish, egoistic, material desires are frustrated. We become angry. When people are not acting the way I want them to be, or when situations aren't turning out the way I want it to be, we become angry and upset. But in the service of Krishna, out of love, out of compassion, out of service, to be angry and accept and upset is actually very divine, yes? Yashoda Mai would become very angry and upset with Krishna, wasn't she? But it was out of love. It wasn't out of frustrated ego. So in bhakti, we learn how to use all of these human sentiments, instead of just giving them up, trying to channel them in a healthy way toward love and devotion and seva. Thank you.
Hare Krishna Prabhuji. Prabhuji, what is your experience in learning Sanskrit?
My experience in learning Sanskrit? I wish I learned more and I knew more. I only know a little. But it's a beautiful language, because not only is it the mother of all languages of this world, but it's a transcendental sound vibration, Sanskrit. It's the language of the spiritual world. It's the language of the most ancient rishis and yogis. It's the language in which Ram spoke in Ramayana, Krishna spoke in Gita, Shiva spoke in Shiva Purana. So, when my guru, Srila Prabhupada, every morning and every evening, actually, he would have us have class at our ashrams. Srimad Bhagavatam class in the morning, Bhagavad Gita class in the evening. And he would have us reciting the Sanskrit before we would speak the class of a verse each day. And he told us that this language is so purifying and so sacred. Just by hearing the vibration of the Sanskrit verses, the slokas, it opens our hearts to actually get deep understanding of the meaning. He said, even if we do not intellectually understand what the vibration means, just hearing it opens and purifies our heart. So when we understand the sacredness of Sanskrit and we hear it with that consciousness, it's very beautiful. But because I've, over the years of my life, I've had so many sevas, so many services to so many people, I haven't really had the time to sit and deeply go into Sanskrit the way I would like to.
Prabhuji, did you ever have divine Krishna's darshan?
Have I had Krishna's divine darshan? My Guru Maharaj would say, do not try to see Krishna, but try to serve Krishna in a way that he's pleased to see you. So I'm trying to be like that.
With that, we come to the end of the question answers and the end of our program. And for all of you Journey Home Book Club members, we want to let you know that we want to continue to facilitate your interactions with the author and connect you to more programs which will help you on your own inward journeys. You have also perhaps all picked up a feedback form from the outside. We would really appreciate if you could fill this up and hand it to the desk outside. Plus, there are volunteers on the desk who will inform you of further courses, seminars, chat groups, all the things that we offer you to remain connected to us. There is a unique course on the journey of self-discovery. You may sign up for that at the registration counter. And there are many more books written by His Holiness Radhanath Swami available outside. You may pick up copies of The Journey Home. You can get it signed by His Holiness after the program. And we do want to remain in touch with you. So please do come forward, keep in touch in whatever way you deem fit. If you fill up the feedback form and tick the certain things which you would like to continue remaining in touch with, like there are inspirational emails, there are updates about new books, there are more Journey Home Book Club meets, and several others, we will remain in touch with you in that way. Also, I want to say that today there are very many who've made it to this book club event. I cannot call out everybody's names, but there are some names who have graced the occasion and have taken the trouble to be with us. I would like to thank Mr. A.C. Shukla, the tax commissioner, for being with us today. Then Dr. Parker, Dean of KEM Hospital. Mrs. Asha Bhosle, the ex-mayor of Satara. Miss Soni, who is a budding Bollywood actress. Mr. and Mrs. Jyoti Nikunj Parikh, who are the Bonsai King and Queen of India. Mrs. Rekha Bhagat, who is the illustrious mother of the authors Chetan and Ketan Bhagat, who need no introduction. And we also have Ms. Subbalakshmi Chakraborty, CEO of the Bank of Mauritius. There are several others. I beg for forgiveness. I'm not calling out your names, but thank you to each one of you for being here and making this event special. And finally, thank you so much, Radhanath Swami Maharaj, for being here, for gracing the occasion, for giving us the inspiration for changing our lives, for trying to do something with our lives too. Thank you so much. Please do join us for dinner downstairs. Good night. Hare Krishna. Please come forward for book signing at any point.
I'd also like to thank our publishers, Jaiko, is it Ashish?
Akash.
Could you stand up, please? Akash. He is the publisher, Jaiko, who is so kindly making the journey home available to all of us. And I want to say, Akash, that it's nothing but a pleasure and an honor to serve with you. Thank you very much.